Welcome to the StoryGrid Editor Roundtable Podcast. This is a show dedicated to helping you become a better editor, following the StoryGrid method developed by Sean Coyne, an editor with over 25 years' experience. My name is Kim Kessler, and I'll be moderating the roundtable today. Joining me shortly are four of my fellow certified StoryGrid editors, Jari Bolander, Valerie Francis, Anne Hawley, and Leslie Watts. Each week, we watch a movie from one of the 12 content genres and complete a global, a global foolscap worksheet, then discuss it using the editor's six core questions. This week, we're analyzing the 1969 movie True Grit, the first film adaptation of the 1968 novel of the same name by Charles Portis. The screenplay was written by Marguerite Roberts and directed by Henry Hathaway. It stars Kim Darby as Maddie Ross and John Wayne as U.S. Marshal Rooster Cogburn, whose performance won him his only Academy Award. Here's a synopsis adapted from Wikipedia. When family man Frank Ross is murdered in Fort Smith by his drunken farmhand Tom Cheney, Ross's 15-year-old daughter Maddie travels to the town to claim his body. She learns that Tom Cheney has escaped Arkansas justice by fleeing to Indian Territory, modern-day Oklahoma, in company with the Lucky Ned Pepper gang of train robbers. Maddie hires the aging and drunken U.S. Marshal Reuben Rooster J. Cogburn, a man of true grit, to capture Cheney and bring him back to hang for his crime. Over Maddie's protests, a young Texas Ranger named LaBeef, who is also pursuing Cheney, joins forces with Rooster Cogburn. The two men try to leave her behind, but she pursues them until they agree to let her join the hunt. At a remote cabin, they find two horse thieves taking shelter. Rooster captures and interrogates them, and one of them reveals that Ned Pepper and his gang are planning a train robbery and will be there soon. The other thief kills him for snitching, and Rooster kills him. Rooster and LaBeef set a trap for Ned Pepper's gang, but the inexperienced LaBeef fires on them too soon and blows their cover. A gunfight ensues, killing two of the gang, while Ned and the others escape. Maddie, Rooster, and LaBeef carry the four bodies to a settlement, where they get more information about the gang. Maddie refuses to stay behind, and the three resume their pursuit. As they near Ned Pepper's hideout, Maddie finds herself face-to-face with Tom Cheney. She shoots him, but doesn't kill him, and before Rooster and LaBeef can help her, Ned Pepper takes her hostage. He will kill her if the two lawmen don't let them go. Pepper and the rest of the gang depart, leaving Tom Cheney behind to guard Maddie, who believes she's been abandoned. Rooster and LaBeef double back. LaBeef rescues Maddie, while Rooster charges the four escaping outlaws by himself, guns blazing. He kills two of them and mortally wounds Ned Pepper, but Pepper shoots Cogburn's horse, trapping his leg underneath it. LaBeef makes a long shot from the hillside, killing Ned before Ned can kill Rooster. Meanwhile, back at the camp, Cheney's not down. He surprises LaBeef, striking him on the head with a rock, apparently fatally. Maddie shoots at Cheney again, but the recoil from her father's oversized pistol sends her tumbling into a snake pit where she breaks her arm, becomes pinned, and is eventually bitten by a rattlesnake. Rooster appears, shoots Cheney dead, and descends into the pit to rescue Maddie. The mortally injured LaBeef revives and helps them out of the pit, saving their lives, but he dies from the effort. Rooster runs Maddie's pony, Little Blackie, to death, racing her to get medical help. He carries her across the country on foot, then steals a wagon, and finally gets her to a doctor. Sometime later, back in Fort Smith, Maddie's lawyer comes to Rooster, pays him what Maddie owed him for the job, plus a reward for saving her life, but says that Maddie is still gravely ill. In the epilogue, Maddie is back home and recovering and shows Rooster her father's headstone and offers him a place after death in the family burial plot. Rooster reluctantly agrees but makes no promises that it will happen anytime soon. He rides off, waving his cowboy hat and jumping his horse over a high fence. Okay, so now that we have a little insight into what happens in True Grit, Anne, will you walk us through the amazing global genre that is Western?
Yeah, the global genre is Western, needless to say. But what is a Western? It's a really weird genre, and I struggle with whether it should even be a genre, since there's really only one thing that sets it apart consistently from this meld of action, crime, and society that it's basically made up of. The one thing is the setting. It's the Western is always set in a harsh or hostile or wide open landscape. The landscape plays a major role in the Western. It's typically, but not always, in the United States and typically west of the Mississippi, but not always. And there are Westerns set in Australia. There are Westerns set in Japan. It can be all over the place. And usually, but not always, in the four decades that follow the American Civil War, leading up to about 1900 or 1905 or so. This Western has a subgenre of professional. And again, the subgenres are also sort of strange, but this is where the protagonist is either a career criminal, like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, just making a living, or a law enforcement professional. And here we have both. Rooster Cogburn is kind of an outlaw at heart. He is an outlaw, but he happens to carry a badge. And then LaBeef, who is actually a law-abiding Texas Ranger, although he's quite naive. So the value at stake in a Western varies a little bit by subgenre, which is another difficulty in defining it. But most often it has to do with personal liberty or freedom versus subjugation. And it usually is told from the perspective or about a free living man who clashes with civilized society. In this case, it's told from the perspective of a young girl, but she is telling the story of this man, Rooster Cogburn. He has a slight redemption arc that plays off sort of the unchanging upright primness of the narrative device character, who's Mattie Ross, the girl. I don't think the morality arc is super strong in this movie, but I think it supports the ending and is part of the reason why John Wayne won an Oscar for playing the role.
Hmm. Awesome. So
he won an Oscar for this?
Yeah.
Yes, his one Academy Award that he won was for this role.
Okay. And the critics really all said, you know, it was basically John Wayne won the Oscar for playing John Wayne.
That's what I was going to say.
It was a Hail Mary Oscar. I mean, it was his last chance. He was already being treated for cancer. I mean, it's one of
right.
He lived on for
right.
a while, but this was, you know, they knew the end was coming. He'd been in 200 movies by this time.
Oh, my God.
200
goodness.
Movies? Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, tons of little B-Westerns back in the 30s.
Yeah, because, I mean, this is definitely like Rooster is John Wayne.
Absolutely.
I mean, this is like, was built for him.
Yep.
So, okay, good to know. I know new trivia for cocktail parties. Awesome.
So does Mattie Ross have an internal genre?
No. She's
no.
unchanging. The book, this movie is very true to the book in many important ways. And Mattie Ross is the most unchanging character you will ever meet. She does not, nothing changes about her in the book. And they give her a little, you know, damsel in distress moment in the movie that isn't necessarily in the book. But she is who she is from beginning to end. Absolutely unchanging.
Okay. So it wouldn't even necessarily be a status admiration because she's so, like, she gets what she wants, as in justice for her father, but it's, that's not the same as what a status admiration plot would be.
No. She has unchanging principles like you do in a status admiration plot, but they're ungenerous principles. They're just these little prim principles.
Right.
So,
right. Okay.
She's not a status hero, admiration hero, I don't think. I'll make that argument anyway.
So, Valerie, you had a really interesting note here about genre. Go ahead and talk that through.
I was just thinking while Anne was talking when she said that she struggled with whether Western should be a genre at all because it's an amalgam of action, crime, and society. And that made me think of the thriller, which is itself an amalgam of action, crime, and horror. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering if then we can see a Western as sort of being similar to thriller in that it's a combination of more fundamental genres.
Yeah.
And interestingly, we've got action and crime in both. And I know when we talked about thriller in previous episodes, we said, you know, in some thrillers, we're going to see more of the action playthrough, or we might see more of the crime playthrough. But I'm curious now, as we do more Western films, if we're going to see one of these fundamental root genres bubble up to the surface in some of them and others will see others. You know, if we'll see sort of crime come up in more in one, society show up in more in another, that kind of
Aren't
thing.
Aren't they most, I mean, I think every Western I've ever seen has got some sort of crime in it.
Yeah.
So in thriller, I think we've had a little trouble with thriller before, just in what the value at stake was, right? Like, is it life and death, which we know it is, but then it also sometimes really does feel like that justice injustice value shift. Same here with Western, it's that individualism versus subjugation, freedom, you know, that kind of thing, as well as justice and injustice. So it's almost like the way to get justice in a thriller would be by sacrificing your life. Here it's almost like the sacrifice of the hero changes depending on the genre. But it's all, it's still all very, feels like the point is to get justice for the crime, you know, for the crime.
Yeah.
It's a really good point. What the hero sacrifices it, based on the value at stake in the genre, that would be a really good way of judging the genre.
Yeah. Interesting. We'll have to write that down and then let's put it to a test in another episode. That would be great. Leslie, will you walk us through the beginning hook, middle build, and ending payoff?
Okay, so again, as Anne said, even though Maddie is our POV character, I'm looking at this from Rooster Cogburn's point of view. So for the beginning hook, I have the inciting incident. Rooster arrives in Fort Smith, and Maddie Ross wants to hire him to capture Tom Chaney and bring him to justice there in Fort Smith. The progressive complication I see as Maddie gets the money to hire him. Then the turning point is that LaBeef offers the opportunity for more money and doesn't want Maddie along. So the crisis, I think, is whether Rooster allows Maddie to come along on the quest, or does he ditch her and leave her in Fort Smith? And the climax, Rooster and LaBeef try to ditch her at the ferry, but she swims her horse across the river.
She's a badass.
She is. And Rooster is fondly reminded of himself in that moment, and so he lets her stay. The resolution there is they head to Rooster's informant's place. Then we, you know, into the middle build, the inciting incident is that the informant tells Rooster that Pepper, who is said to be with Chaney, had been seen at McAllister's 3 days before. The progressive complication is that Moon reveals that Pepper is on his way to that cabin, and Pepper and the others escape from the trap that Rooster, Aunt Cogburn, and LaBeef set there. And that's the turning point, I would say. The crisis is when they arrive at McAllister's, do they leave Maddie there or take her with them? And the climax, again, he tries to leave her, but LaBeef and Maddie argue that she has a right to go, and Rooster acquiesces. They ride on, and Rooster acts like a petulant child who hasn't gotten his way. In the ending payoff, the inciting incident is Maddie encounters Chaney and shoots him at a stream near Pepper's hideout. But basically, what then happens is that Ned Pepper gets a hold of Maddie and tells Rooster, if you leave, I'll free her. So essentially, Maddie's safety is dependent on Rooster walking away. So then Rooster's crisis is, does he leave Maddie? You know, once again, does he leave her, or does he trick Pepper and go after her, try to save her? And the climax here, he pretends to leave her, but he comes back to fight Pepper and his men while LaBeef helps Maddie and kills Pepper before Rooster meets his demise. So the resolution then, Rooster saves Maddie from the hole where she fell and gets her to a doctor in time to save her. So I started it at kind of an odd place in a way, because you would say for the inciting incident, I think for the whole story would be the killing of Maddie's father by Tom Chaney. But in terms of Rooster, and in terms of if we're just looking at the beginning hook, I think it really begins when Rooster comes and Maddie wants to hire him. His desire at that point becomes to either be left alone or give me the money. So that's kind of where I put it there. And since that was unusual, I wanted to mention it.
Well, I would have argued strenuously for the inciting incident being the murder of Frank Ross, Maddie's father. But Leslie makes a really good point that when we're looking at the story from the point of view that Rooster is actually the protagonist of the story, then, yeah, his story begins when Maddie attempts to hire him.
I've struggled with this in a lot of stories in looking at what are the five commandments of the global story, and then looking at what are the five commandments of the beginning hook, middle build, ending payoff. And sometimes they're the same. You know, sometimes the inciting incident is the same, but sometimes it feels like it's a little different. And so I think it's just really important, either as editors or writers, when we're looking at the story, to think about it from the perspective of, like, if we're looking at the beginning hook, like, ring fence the events of the beginning hook and look at it as if it's a story, and then look at the five commandments that way, because they might be different from the global.
Right. Okay. The inciting incident of the global story can sometimes feel different than the inciting incident of specifically the beginning hook, especially if, in this case, you know, we start with the narrator character story versus the protagonist Rooster story, and how those are different things. So yeah, really interesting stuff. Okay, so Anne, if you would walk us through the obligatory scenes of a Western.
I will. As with most stories, there are 8 obligatory scenes based on the hero's journey. And the first one in a Western is an inciting attack by the villain or the environment. In this case, it's the villain, Tom Chaney. He's one of the villains, murders Frank Ross, Maddie's father. That's pretty straightforward, and that's why the inciting attack and what I assumed was the inciting incident were the same thing. The second one is the hero sidesteps responsibility to take action, and Rooster does this beautifully. He initially refuses the job because it's being offered by this little sister, he calls her through the story, of hunting down Tom Chaney, and then he not only starts by refusing, but he strings her along. He demands double what she's offering to pay him. And he thinks this is going to put her off. So that's his refusal. Of course, it doesn't. And he is forced to leave the ordinary world. So that's the third one, forced to leave the ordinary world. The hero lashes out. Rooster's ordinary world is carefree and lawless and violent. I think the lashing out is best demonstrated by that wonderful scene where he delivers his writ on a rat, where he shoots the rat in Chen Li's house. Uh-huh. He's beginning to accept that this girl, this persistent little girl, isn't going to go away, and that he'll probably accept the job. So he gets really drunk and he shoots a rat. And this, in a parody, it's a parody of his own lawlessness and his own methods of dealing with criminals. And it's also, I think, his form of lashing out. I would be happy to take argument on that. The fourth one is discovering and understanding the villain's object of desire. This one's pretty straightforward. In the cabin where they have the ambush and the two horse thieves, snitchers, disclose that Ned Pepper's gang is planning to rob a train and they will be coming to the cabin. It's all about money. The villain's object of desire seems to be pretty straightforwardly about money. The fifth obligatory scene is the hero's initial strategy to outmaneuver the villain fails. This is certainly not unique to the Western. Ned Pepper and some of his gang escape this wonderful ambush that they've set up when LaBeef gets trigger-happy and starts a gunfight. So the sixth one is the hero, realizing that he must change his approach in order to salvage some form of victory, reaches an all-is-lost moment. This is at the end of the middle build. And again, I'll take argument on this, but Rooster has been, after they leave the settlement and they're heading off together to confront Ned Pepper's hideout, he's been drinking all day. He's getting drunker and drunker to the point where he actually falls off his horse. And he's lost the battle to leave Maddie behind. Both LaBeef, Glenn Campbell, and Maddie gang up on him and make him agree to take her along. And so they're camped, and Maddie points out that he's working for her. He says in his drunkenness that no man will ever work for a woman. And Maddie says, well, you're working for me. And and it's his all-is-lost moment. The old way is gone. He's working for a woman. So he corks his whiskey bottle. And it's a really subtle little moment, but it's like he puts the cork in the whiskey bottle and that's it. His old way is gone. So the seventh obligatory scene is the hero at the mercy of the villain, of course. And it's the moment when the hero's gift is expressed. So this is very clear when Maddie has been taken prisoner and Rooster appears to admit his defeat and abandon her. And he rides off and then he comes back alone, riding directly at the four gangsters with all, you know, guns blazing. It's a wonderful, iconic Western scene. And he almost defeats them, but he is literally at the mercy of the villain when Pepper shoots his horse out from under him and he's lying there pinned under the horse. And he has a little conversation with Pepper and he's reaching for his rifle, which he's just out of reach, to try and kill Ned Pepper. And then LaBeouf is the one who, in the sort of Han Solo classic moment of swooping in the sidekick gets in one decent shot and kills Ned Pepper. Now, I'm not sure how that shows the hero's gift, except that Rooster Cogburn was willing to have LaBeouf along and give him another chance, I guess. But it really, it was more LaBeouf gets that one moment of glory before he dies. And the final obligatory scene is the hero's sacrifice is rewarded. So Rooster sacrifices his own horse and Maddie's horse and almost his life to save Maddie. And he is rewarded with money, which was always his main goal, and it never stops being his main motivation. But he's also rewarded with a symbolic place in the Ross family. He's given a family in the sense that Maddie offers him a final resting place in the family burial plot. So it's a little sentimental moment in the epilogue where he gets the sort of moral reward.
So I have a question for you, Anne. Mm. It's like the hero at the mercy of the villain is when he's pinned under the horse and Ned Pepper's coming after him and then LaBeouf shoots Ned Pepper. And then, but I was thinking of the hero's gift is expressed also when Rooster shoots Chaney and rescues Maddie from the snake pit. Right? Where does that play in? Is that just kind of secondary one of those? Or
I guess you could say it's a long extended moment of the hero at the mercy of the villain, and then the hero's gift is expressed because it's right together. These things happen one right after the other in the climax of the story.
Right, right.
So, yeah, I mean, his gift is expressed in the sense that he's pretty determined to have his way, and at that point his way is to save Maddie. It's not one scene. There are two separate scenes, but they're right on top of each other.
I was curious what you guys think of the Maddie character in all this. Because for this was made in 1969, right?
Mm-hmm.
She's not a damsel in distress type of character.
Not until she's down in that pit.
Right, right. It's not like, oh, help me, la, la, la.
I'm in a hole with a broken arm, and there's a rattlesnake about to get
me. Yeah. Even the toughest guy, even John McClane would need help at that point. I'm saying. I'm just curious because, Anne, you've read the book and you're doing your Story Grid edition on this. Is she written that way in the book as
Absolutely.
Well? Because it's a pretty powerful female character that, you know, 1969 movie, I don't know how many of those they actually had.
Published in 68, so, you know, it was a big, big bestseller, 22 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, so that's why they made a movie out of it. Yes, the movie is truest of all to the Maddie character, I think, from the book. She's a narrative device in a lot of ways because she's telling her own story in the book. It's all written in the first person, and she's telling her own story from a distance of many years. She's looking back as an old woman telling the story, which doesn't come through in the movie at all.
Interesting. So in the book, it's her flashing back to how this whole thing went down.
It's not flashing back, though. She's telling the story. You get it's brilliantly written. It's a very, very entertaining, very well-written book, and it's short, 210 pages or something. She is telling this story, and you know that as you go through it, she has never told it any other way. She's told it more than once in her life.
Mm-hmm.
It is always exactly the same, and in, you know, just a masterpiece of dramatic irony. She never quite realizes that she's not the hero of the story she's telling. She thinks she is.
Mm.
And she's inadvertently describing this hero. who's mm-hmm. kind of a no-count, lawless, drunken, socially unacceptable Western hero. And so, yeah, the movie is very true to her voice. And Maddie is Maddie from beginning to end of her whole life, unchanging.
I just really liked something that Anne said at the beginning here. She said there were 8 obligatory scenes which follows the hero's journey. And we always get a lot of questions from writers who are struggling with their obligatory scenes and conventions for their chosen genre. And of course, the hero's journey works better with some genres than others. But I think Anne, you know, hit the nail on the head here with this, that in a Western especially, the obligatory scenes follow the hero's journey. So that's just a really great way for people who are writing their stories to think about their obligatory scenes and conventions. Are they following the hero's journey? And if people don't know what I'm talking about the hero's journey, Christopher Vogler's book, The Writer's Journey, is a fantastic explanation. Look at those stages and see if that's what you're writing, and therefore you automatically know what some of your obligatory scenes are.
I was just thinking that when Rooster tries to leave Maddie at the ferry is another possibility for Rooster lashing out. But I also wanted to say that how well suited is his reward for his sacrifice, that he gets his freedom to wander around and do and be who he is and know that he has this final resting place, that he has a family, that he has a place where he belongs if he chooses to have it. And so since his sacrifice in part during the ending payoff or during the whole story really is giving up some of his individual freedom, mm-hmm. His reward is he gets that back, but he gets to keep the good stuff that comes with being tied down.
Right. The belonging.
Good point.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got a good look at the beginning hook, middle build, ending payoff. We've got a good look at the obligatory scenes. So Valerie, will you walk us through the conventions here of a Western?
Okay, the very first one is that you have a harsh, hostile, wide open landscape as a character. And the scenery in this film is absolutely breathtaking. And there's no doubt that it's the landscape becomes a character in the film once Maddie, Rooster, and LaBeef set out on their journey to find Chaney and ultimately Ned Pepper. You know, you constantly see Maddie chasing the others on the horse through these beautiful, beautiful tracts of land. They have to go through areas that are very high grass, so that's an obstacle for them. They have to shoot their own food, like LaBeef shoots a turkey, mangles the turkey. And Rooster twice comments to Maddie about how rough it's going to be out there. He says, there's no hot grub or warm bed out there, he says, you know, in the wilderness. And at one point when Maddie asks, isn't it dinner time? He said, dinner time will come and go without notice on this trip. So it definitely becomes one of the characters and is one of the things that they have to manage on their journey. And in fact, it's nature that is the thing that threatens to kill Maddie. It's not even Chaney or Pepper. It's nature in the form of the falling into a pit. That's the landscape and the snake in the pit. I know Anne had, as our resident True Grit
True
expert.
True Grit expert.
Yeah.
Just what you wanted to be known as, Anne.
Well,
a woman of True Grit.
That's me. The story takes place in Arkansas and then moves into what's now Oklahoma. And that's explicit in the movie. It's Fort Smith. And then they suddenly are in the Colorado Rockies, which is a very Hollywood sort of choice. The novel is set in December. Part of the harshness is the snow and really, really hard conditions. So the movie choice, this Hollywood-y movie choice to film in the autumn with the golden aspens in the Colorado Rockies, you can just hear John Denver singing, and a bunch of day-for-night shots, it was actually decreased the sense of jeopardy or stakes from the original story in favor of just visual beauty. Not necessarily a bad choice, but and possibly because John Wayne was getting pretty old and they probably couldn't film in the snow in the winter in you know, that I mean, there were probably practical reasons for it. But it's worth noting.
I was waiting for Glenn Campbell to start singing. I mean, it's
yeah,
such
get
a
out his guitar.
Yeah, I mean, it's a beautiful, beautiful scenery for sure.
I love that Hollywoodization. I have been through this part of the world where the story is supposed to have taken place several times, right? And it's not at all. There are no aspens in Arkansas or Oklahoma. It's really different. And so I was thinking about two things in regard to this. One is that we can get tripped up when we're watching a film and they do something like that. You know, when they have made a choice for whatever reason, and it pulls us out of the story a little bit. And the thing to do in those moments, of course, is to have our, you know, I had my little tantrum. Oh my gosh, couldn't they be accurate about this? But then to move on and think about, as Anne has done, you know, why might they have made these choices? Because these are we're talking about filming in the context of this movie here, but we could just as easily be talking about point of view, you know, or why this scene now, that those kinds of things. And so thinking about why the artists make the decisions they make is really important. So that's one thing. And then another thing I was thinking about is that it seems that movies today, television shows that we watch, they seem to strive for more accuracy. We were talking earlier and that we have better technology and can digitally remove certain goofs. But if you look at the notes in the Amazon version of the movie, there are so many goofs here. And so it's really interesting to me that I'm not used to those kinds of things, like seeing blood that looks like a paintball.
It's really splatter. Bad. And no bullet holes in the shirts.
And no bullet holes.
I mean, it's the same thing as in A Midnight Clear, right? It looks like ketchup.
It's for, you know, for us to look past those kinds of things. Especially these older films, there are different sensibilities too. And if we can kind of keep those in mind, but then also, like, I found myself resistant to this story until when I was watching it for the second time. And then I was kind of noticing the cool things. And so I kind of got past my resistance and the veneer of 1969 and was able to see it as a valuable story that has something to say. And it was interesting.
I think that's a great philosophy to have when approaching stories that feel kind of out of date or out of the times, out of our current technological abilities that are, you know, they feel old fashioned or hokey or anything like that. But the story itself, however it's rendered, right, like the method that it's rendered, whether through film or, you know, in text or whatever, the story itself still exists. And we know this certainly from looking at Pride and Prejudice, where, you know, we don't talk like that anymore, but there's so much value in there. So even if it isn't to your personal taste, or we have a hard time not seeing the blooper, to still dig in for the story. And it was funny, Leslie, as you were talking, I was like, well, that just seems like a good way of looking at people, you know, it's just like, why would they make this choice? Realizing that they might have a reason and we don't necessarily know everything. So that's pretty valuable.
Okay, so the second convention is that the roles of the hero, the victim, and the villain have to be clearly defined. And I picked up on the same thing that Leslie mentioned at the outset, in that there's kind of two stories happening here. So we've got the issue of Frank Ross, in that little story, Maddie is the hero for insisting that her father's killer be brought to justice. Her father, Frank Ross, is the victim, and Tom Chaney is the villain. Now, if you look at the global story where Rooster Cogburn is the hero, Maddie then becomes the victim and Ned Pepper is the villain. And I'm saying Maddie is the victim. Obviously, we've got Glenn Campbell, whose character, LaBeef. I have a hard time remembering that his name is LaBeef. I just see Rhinestone Cowboy. So he's clearly the sidekick in that trio, and Maddie is the victim twice. You know, she's taken hostage and she falls down the snake pit. That's the big scene at the end of the film. But he also saves her from LaBeef when LaBeef pins her down and starts whacking her with a stick, and he enjoys it too much. Okay, so the third the third convention is that the hero's object of desire is to stop the villain and save the victim. So Maddie, as the hero, is laser focused on finding Chaney. While Chaney's victim, Frank Ross, is dead and therefore beyond saving, Maddie can avenge her father's death. So she's not trying to save the victim. She's trying to avenge his death. So that's not quite on point, but it isn't the global story either. Now, if we move over to the Rooster, Maddie, Pepper scenario, Rooster wants to find Chaney for the reward money. And he wants to find Ned to settle a score. He wants to keep Maddie safe and does so several times. Twice he tries to keep her from going on the journey, you know, leaving her behind at the ferry crossing, and also telling her to stay at the McAllisters when he goes to Ned. He saves Maddie from LaBeef's beating. He saves her from Ned when she's been kidnapped. And after she's been bitten by the snake, he brings her to the doctor at great cost to himself. The fourth convention is that the hero operates outside the law, either selectively or as a matter of course. For Maddie, it's a matter of course. She has to take the law into her own hands because the local sheriff's office in Fort Smith is doing nothing anymore. They say they can't because Chaney is an Indian nation, and that's under federal jurisdiction. Anne already mentioned the trial scene, which is brilliant. I just thought it was, and now I want to read it in the book. If it's even better in the book, I definitely want to read the book. The defense attorney paints a very clear picture of Rooster as a man who operates outside the law. He killed 23 people in 4 years as a marshal, and there's doesn't seem to be any particular justification for it other than he wanted to. And the lawyer becomes so frustrated with Rooster's disregard for the law and the court of law that he just stops questioning him. Throughout the film, there are other little references sprinkled throughout to Rooster's unconventional approach to his job. For example, he doesn't buy his whiskey. He confiscates it. Prior to becoming a marshal, he steals money from a federal paymaster, but he doesn't even consider it stealing. He looks at it kind of as a loan to get him started in his restaurant business. And he plans on shooting Ned without giving a call. Now, this is something, that little line I only picked up sort of when I was going back for the third time and just looking at some scenes. And that's the part where the Moon and the other guy are dead and they're waiting for Ned and his gang to come. And he's laying out the plan for Maddie and LaBeef. And he says, okay, the first guy comes out, we'll just shoot him. And LaBeef says, you mean you're just going to shoot without giving a call? So it's sort of like the code of honor or an unwritten rule that you shout out, you know, come out with your hands up or something like that first to give them chance. And Rooster has no intention. You know, eventually he says, yeah, okay. Well, after the first guy's dead, then I'll call. The fifth convention, the power divide between the hero and the villain is very large. The villain is far more powerful than the hero. So in the Maddie Chaney story, that is clear. Maddie's just a young girl, whereas Chaney is a murderer and wanted in two states. And LaBeef even says it'll take two men to take Chaney alive. In the Rooster Ned story, I think in terms of their personalities, there isn't a huge power divide. They seem to be fairly matched. And in fact, Ned was even able to get away from Rooster, but not without getting shot in the lower lip, even though Rooster was aiming for the upper lip. That was a funny line. However, when you look at this particular scenario, you've got Rooster who's traveling with a young girl, and she is a hindrance. He has to constantly look after her, so she's a distraction. And his other traveling companion is a Texas Ranger without a lot of experience, seemingly, and who obviously is not a great shot. I mean, he mangles the turkey. He hits Ned's horse. Well, he's a horse killer, he doesn't hit Ned.
Right.
So that's sort of another handicap that he has with him, whereas Ned is traveling with
a gang.
Five or six guys. Gang, yeah. Right?
Yeah, not the Lone Ranger over here.
Exactly. And he even says that even though, like, Maddie asks if one guy is simple-minded, he says, well, you know, they kind of all are, but they're a great shot. And in the final showdown, you've got, in this beautiful scene set up, you've got Rooster on one side of a clearing, and you've got the four outlaws on the other side. So it's literally four on one. So therefore, in that case, the villain does have more power than the hero. Number six, the speech in praise of the villain. There is no speech in praise of Chaney. He is only ever referenced as being a no good and just a loser. When it comes to Ned Pepper, there's no big speech. Instead, there's little references throughout. At no point does Rooster sit down and say, well, that Ned Pepper is quite a guy. No, he doesn't do that. There's body language that sort of gives you an idea as to what Rooster thinks of Ned. He obviously has some sort of, I don't know if admiration is the right word, but acknowledgement that Ned is good at being a bad guy. He won't go after him for $50. He says his price is $100. That is also part of his refusal of the call, as Anne pointed out. But he says it's not going to be easy to smoke old Ned out. So I'm going to need at least $100. Those are the types of things that are there. The end effect of which is that the audience has a very clear picture of Ned as a very strong villain.
I wonder if the speech in praise of the villain isn't delivered more by Moon. I wasn't thinking about it at the time. Moon, the Dennis Hopper character.
Yes.
Dugout. I wonder if he doesn't deliver something. I should go back and look.
No, he definitely does.
Yeah, that's a great point.
He definitely does.
That's a great point.
There's one other moment. So, I think that it is scattered throughout, because I think it's Boots who says, you're going to need 100 men. You're going to need 100 marshals if you're going
right
in there.
When they're at McAllister's, right? Yeah, that's right.
That's right. Yeah. Oh, good point. That's why this is so much fun to do as a group.
Yeah.
Well, you know, because you can watch this a bunch of times yourself, but when you start to work with other writers and other editors who are doing the same thing, you all pick up different things. Good call. All right, finally, number 7, and this is a convention of this particular subgenre, because we're saying that the global is Western, the subgenre is professional, where the law enforcement officers are just doing a job. Rooster is a U.S. Marshal, LaBeef is a Texas Ranger, and although this is absolutely a job for LaBeef, he does have a personal stake in wanting to find Chaney, because he says right at the very beginning when Maddie first meets him, it'll help him curry favor with a woman of high standing because he plans on marrying well. So for Rooster, it's a job. He wants the money from finding Chaney. He totally does want to get rid of Ned because that's a score to settle. But for LaBeef, there's also a personal something in there that he wants to marry well in the end.
Thank you so much. So let's move right along to point of view. Jari?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty obvious to me that this whole story's being told from Maddie's point of view. And there is some third person background. You know, you sort of know what's going on with Rooster and some of the other scenes where Maddie's not in it, but she's pretty much in the whole movie. So yeah, and from what I understood from Anne, again, who's our expert on True Grit and has got True Grit in spades. I think you had some comments on that as well.
Well, I just wanted to add, we talked about it a little earlier, but in the novel, the movie was really, really admiring of the novel. And when you think about the dialogue and the way people speak, they use fewer contractions than you might expect. They do not say the things. It's this almost stilted dialogue that takes a couple of passes to start to get used to. That's straight from the book, and it's Maddie telling the story because that's how Maddie talks. So all the characters talk that way, except for Rooster, who uses a lot of slang and swear words. And the screenplay writer, brought that in very admiringly into the movie. And I think it works. It's a clue that you're seeing the whole world through her point of view, because that's all these people talk in this unlikely way, because that's how Maddie Ross talks.
The dialogue is sparse and very efficient. And is that the way it is in the book? Because sometimes she doesn't understand what they're talking about, and they have to explain it to her. In the movie, it's hard to know the point of view because it's a movie. You're not getting
the
back. Yeah, whereas the camera is like, oh, yeah, point of view. So anyway. Then on the next one, Objects of Desire, a.k.a. Wants and Needs. Now, I did this all from Maddie's perspective, and there's some other perspectives as well, which I think is really valuable because I was looking at it from Maddie. It felt like she was the hero to me, but then as we started talking about it, it's like, well, no, it's really Rooster that's actually enabling Maddie's quest to avenge her father. So when they talk about the wants and needs, Maddie wants to have justice for the murder of her father. Actually, she wants revenge. And then I think for her, the needs is really to be taken serious and respected, even though she's, 15? She's a really strong character and someone that is not going to take crap from anyone. I mean, she's got a lot more, I don't know, she's just got more moxie, I guess.
True grit. She's got more
true grit.
I just thought that the objects of desire were really clearly identified for all three of those characters, Maddie, Rooster, and LaBeef. Rooster wants the money for capturing Chaney, and we already talked about that. And he also wants to bring Ned Pepper finally to justice. But what he needs is a family. He needs an intimate connection with somebody. And that ends up being Maddie. LaBeef wants to catch Chaney so that this woman back in Texas will be impressed with him and he can marry well. But what he needs to do is put other people's needs, other people's priorities or life or whatever, ahead of his own. And he doesn't do that until the very end. The first time that I can remember seeing it is when, just as we turn into the ending payoff, I believe, when Maddie goes down to the river to wash up, and this is where she meets Chaney. As she's going to the river, LaBeef says to Rooster, shouldn't one of us go with her? I mean, this is the guy who was beating her with a stick.
Right.
Now he's concerned about her. And then, of course, when she's in the pit, the snake pit at the end of the film, even though LaBeef has a crushed skull from Chaney having smashed him with a rock, he, with his last dying breaths, manages to get on the horse and help pull not only Maddie, but Rooster out of the snake pit and save them both. Mm-hmm. And he also saves Rooster before that by shooting Ned. Mm-hmm. So he does put them ahead of himself in the end.
Awesome. Now, before we got on the call, we had some really interesting discussion about this next one, the controlling idea and theme. So, Jari, yes. Why don't you start us off, and we'll see where we end up by the end of this thing.
Controlling idea, yeah. We had a bit of a struggle because this really doesn't fit into the normal Western framework. So I think for me, I sort of, again, was taking it from Maddie's perspective, and I know, you know, we'll dive in a little bit more as to why that may not be the best way to look at it. But for me, it was the hero can get what they want if they are confident in what they know and determined to get what they want out of their quest.
So you were coming down to it being confident and determined. That's the...
Yeah. Okay. So
when I'm preparing for these podcasts, I like to go through all of the sections so that I deepen my own knowledge. And when I got to the theme and controlling idea here, I started to tie myself up in knots. If we go back to what Sean talks about with respect to theme, he says theme equals value plus cause. So that's the global value of the story plus the cause of that global value manifesting in the story. So now that we've kind of talked about it a bit, and we know that Western is the combination of action, crime, and society, the value maybe depends on which of those three root genres has bubbled up more than the other two. Like this film, this story really feels like a global value of justice. So this, to me, then it would be maybe justice prevails when something happens, as opposed to if it was an action, it would be life prevails when. I like coming down on the side of the justice prevails when. Anyway, then I start tying myself up in knots. So I'm going to stop there because the rest of it is not my idea. It's all you three, Kim, Ann, and Leslie, all you three digging me out of this hole. Woman in a hole.
Woman in a hole with a rattlesnake.
I think that the thing that distinguishes the Western is the overarching value at stake of liberty or freedom versus some form of subjugation. We talked about this a little earlier, so I think it's important to go to that as the unique value at stake of the Western genre.
Well, I think it's, that's the value at stake for the person. You know, something that Sean has mentioned is the self-reliant individual dangerous to order or necessary to defend the powerless? Mm-hmm. And that there are circumstances in war, in Westerns, where our perception is for safety, we need these heroes who go out and do things that we don't want to think about, we don't want to talk about. We just want them to do it. And it reminds me that the courtroom scene where Rooster Cogburn is, you know, like why are you giving me a hard time about this? Seriously, reminded me so much of Jack Nicholson in A Few Good Men, where right. he's like, we are guarding your civilization from forces that you don't want to deal with. So quit bugging me about how I get that done. And that to me, there's this really interesting tension between sometimes we need guys like that, but it's hard to have them around, and that we don't always deal with, for example, people who go off to war and are changed by it. We don't always deal with, you know, supporting them and helping them after that's over and we no longer need their services. How do we, you know, pay them back?
Before we started recording, Leslie, you had mentioned something, and then we kind of piggybacked on it. At first, you were kind of calling it autonomy, and then we kind of landed about individual liberty. This idea of justice prevails when a person sacrifices his individual liberty for the benefit of a broader society. And so we're kind of going in with that tension of this dangerous person, right? Even though they're dangerous, we need them to give up a little bit of that so that they can help broader society, because they do a specific job that no one else but them can do, right? That's their gift, is that they can do the thing that the rest of us can't do. And we need that in order for justice or life to prevail. So justice prevails when a person sacrifices his individual liberty for the benefit of a broader society. That's kind of where we landed on theme. Does anybody else have anything they want to note or mention about that?
No, I don't think we nailed it absolutely, but I think that's a pretty good starting point for the Western
yes.
in general.
In general, absolutely. Okay, so we've come through our six core questions about True Grit, and we're kind of here now to the end, which is one of my favorite parts, where we do the good examples. So whether it's special scene types or outstanding tropes or clear tie-ins to other genres or just other fun things you liked about the story, Anne, go ahead and start us off.
Yeah, the movie, again, was very true to the novel in its wonderful use of the landscape as symbolism. The story's midpoint shift, which actually comes a little before 50% in the movie, but it's right at 50% in the novel, is marked by crossing a river. There's crossing of water several times in the story at symbolic crossing points, change points, turn points. And then Maddie's final descent into peril, her arc on the story grid is going down as she is literally sliding down into a river ravine and then down further, actually down into a snake pit. It's very nice use of geography and the landscape, which is so important in a Western, as symbolic as well as literal.
Well done, Anne. Holy cow, that was great.
<Thank you. laughs>
It's like you've been studying this book for, you know, mm-hmm. 4 months or something.
Yeah, it's like you know what you're talking about. Oh, my God, this is awesome.
What I really liked was the interplay between the three characters. Now, we've heard Sean say several times that writing a scene with three characters in it is much easier than two characters for both the writer and the reader. And when we did The Bridges of Madison County, it was almost like a masterclass in two-person scenes. You know, we had all those scenes with Meryl Streep and Clint Eastwood, which were so wonderful. But a huge factor, of course, is the acting chops of those two actors. And that was contrasted with the two-person scenes of Francesca's children, which were not so hot. So we kind of got that study of two-person scenes. Now, in this movie, we had a lot of three-person scenes with Maddie, Rooster, and LaBeef. And the interplay between those three characters was way more dynamic, even though intellectually when I heard Sean say this, I thought, okay, yeah, that makes sense. But watching it now here in True Grit and comparing it with what we saw in Bridges of Madison County, it really brought his point to life for me.
My favorite thing of this was the dialogue. I love dialogue. It's one of my favorite things to write, and it's certainly one of my favorite things to read. So it took me a few scenes to really get into it, but once I did, it was just really easy for me to watch, and by the end, I was super sucked in. And I think so much of it is the humor. Humor is a secret sauce to get me in. Humor in a serious story. So anyway, the dialogue and character interplays were certainly one of my most favorite things. And I was so thrilled, Anne, when you told us that the book is just as funny or funnier. And so I can't wait to read it. And just as an aside, I thought it was really interesting that the screenwriter Marguerite Roberts, who adapted the novel, had a 9-year blacklist from Hollywood for refusing to testify for the House Un-American Activities Committee, which John Wayne was a huge advocate for
in
the movie,
really?
And then he ends up winning his Oscar for it. So I was just like, well, there you go, John.
Well, that's the irony, huh? Fun fact. But the thing I like the most is, you know how we were talking about Rooster needs to connect with things? And I think the best thing was when he's talking to his cat, General. And I've got to connect to something. I'm going to connect to a cat.
Well, and he says a cat belongs to no one at some point.
Right,
I think,
exactly.
Right? That's how he is. So he admires the cat.
Right,
he says the cat belongs to no one, just like him, right?
Right.
The audiobook of True Grit is read by Donna Tartt, an author in her own right and a great one. She's actually a native of Arkansas and does the accent beautifully. It's a wonderful audiobook, and I highly recommend it.
Awesome. Leslie, I heard you pipe up there. What do you got to say?
Yeah, I was just going to say my favorite line is bold talk for a one-eyed fat man. As insults go, Robert.
The other one that was great for Maddie, which, like, this is so gangster. I paid good cash money to be here. I mean, that is legit gangster right there.
Yeah, so definitely, you've got to check it out. You got to watch the movie and read the book and the audiobook to get the hilarious dialogue. It's so fantastic. So I think that wraps it up for this week. Great discussion, you guys. It's always so much fun. Thank you, Anne, Jari, Leslie, and Valerie for our excellent editorial insights into True Grit. We hope our discussion helps you, your clients, write a better Western story. Links to the Foolscap and other materials will be in the show notes. We'd like to invite all of our listeners to comment, argue with us and our interpretations, and just generally keep the conversation going. We're on Twitter at StoryGridRT. Join us next time when we are taking on the worldview genre with Dead Poets Society. It was my pick, and I'm so very excited about it. We encourage you to watch it with us this week so you can follow along with us, and we'll see you next week.